All right, let's open it up. See if you got any thoughts. You want to tell me what I did wrong, or how we could, I could phrase it better? Because there's always, with this topic, believe me, there really are always ways that it could be phrased more delicately or better. All right, go ahead, sir.
Could you shed any light on Catholic social doctrine, particularly solidarity and subsidiarity?
Oh, yes, I could shed so little light on that. This should go quick. Okay. All right. No, I think I can. The church does believe but let's start with subsidiarity. I'm gonna try to explain it. You tell me if this is completely wacko, but I think I can do it. The church has a doctrine called the universal destination of all creation. You ever heard of that? The universal destination of all creation? All right. That means this. Why did God make the universe? He made it for humans, okay? This is a doctrine of the church. All of this was made for people, okay? And who in particular was it made for? Which person? That the church says, not a particular person, for all people. So all of the universe is meant for all of the people. That's how God gives his gifts, okay? So what is this universe for? Us, not me. I mean, it is me, I'm part of us, but I mean, it's not like it's not for me, but not me alone, it's not my universe, it's our universe, okay? So there's this idea of the universal destination of all goods, but what the church says, and particularly in the Ten Commandments we see this, is the proper way to live out the universal destination of all goods is to be respectful of our personal, of private property, okay? You have a right to own things, to claim part of the world as yours, to build something up, and now it belongs to you, okay? So the universal destination of goods is not a communist idea. It's an idea where we have to say, the first thing is this, when it comes from God, it's for everybody, okay? But the way that we live that out, because we are individuals, is by making sure that everybody has access to these goods that God has given us. Now, some people really lack access, okay? I'm not talking about people who are like, you know, I'm oppressed, you know, because I'm one quarter Ukrainian and everyone knows that, you know, no, come on, all right? There's sometimes we're just complaining. But there are millions and millions and millions of people on this earth who truly don't have access to the goods they should have out of God's universal gift, all right? So you think of the kids who live on the streets of Rio de Janeiro, 6 and 7 year olds abandoned, alone, unable to get what they need even to live without being involved in all kinds of horrible things. Okay? Those people have been denied what even the little piece of the universal good that God has given us. Therefore, they come first. We owe them. Okay? I'm not talking about the person who's a complainer and a whiner and, oh, poor me, I'm oppressed and I didn't get my... No, all right? That's not what I'm talking about. You are all pretty much able to make it to Phil's barbecue tonight. You're doing okay. You're not living on the streets of Rio. But those people have as much right to a wholesome amount of God's creation as you have. That means there's what we call the preferential option for the poor. We have to, before we take care of anything else, if you and I have an argument, before we even, you know, go, all right, let's settle our property dispute, well, what about the guy who's dying in the street? First, we should go pick him up and take care of him, okay? That's what preferential option for the poor means. Now, subsidiarity, and so solidarity is a way of living so that we're living as if everybody has a right to the goods that God has given, and we ally ourselves. Let's say somebody comes from some oppressed part of the world, like, I don't know, Britain, okay? And we all have to stand with that person and support that person and lift that person. That's what solidarity is, okay? Solidarity is that it's not I'm out for myself type of thing. I have obligations to other people. I have obligations to myself as well, but I have obligations to other people. Okay, so that subsidiarity is very hard to get at, but the basic idea of subsidiarity is that things people should be equipped both by education and by their formation and by the laws of where they lived to take care of their own problems. Okay? People should not be made dependent on higher authorities to solve their problems. Okay? Now, I know that in American politics, lots of people see subsidiarity as conservatism. And in many ways, they do jibe with one another. The Catholic teaching on subsidiarity, I would submit to you, is deeper and more firmly rooted intellectually even than the best traditions of American, or the good solid traditions of American conservatism. But the basic idea is a family should have what it needs to solve its own problems. If the family can't solve it, maybe the clan or the church. I don't mean the clan like the KKK. I mean, sorry, that came out wrong. A little, well, let's have the clan solve it. That's subsidiarity. No, but you know, in some societies, you go from family to clan. Okay, so forget it. Tribe, your tribe. Yes, like in Britain, tribes. Okay, so like Manchester United is a tribe over there. Okay, so the basic idea of subsidiarity is the small group shouldn't be robbed of the ability to take care of itself. All right, so. Pope Benedict has made a suggestion that I have not read about. I've only had someone explain it to me, so I can't refer you to a source. But the idea is that one of the things that Pope Benedict thinks is that we should pay taxes, but we should be, then local communities should make decisions about how the taxes are used. Okay? So that would mean, it's, for example, if you have your local school, the local people should make the decisions about the local school, not the federal government or the UN, okay? Like if the UN is making decisions about your local school, there's a serious lack of subsidiarity going on. All right, I hope I have explained that adequately or confused you adequately. I don't know. Anybody else? What do you got? Yeah.
What books would you recommend on citizenship?
Well, I would recommend all those things that I suggested. I think a very good book is The Naked Public Square by Richard John Neuhaus. Have any of you read The Naked Public Square? Also, I think George Weigel's book, Letter to a Young Catholic, is a very, very good book. Any of you know George Weigel or seen his stuff? No? Yeah, he's good. So those are the two that come to my mind right off the top. I mean, a lot of people, the Jesuit John Courtney Murray is the great Catholic thinker about the American civic life. But I find it so hard to read John Courtney Murray, I can't recommend him. I mean, I know he's great, but I only know he's great by reputation because I'm usually asleep by like two paragraphs in. So give it a shot. If you're a really good reader, read John Courtney Murray. Go for it. Tell me if it's good. But I would say The Naked Public Square and Letter to a Young Catholic are both good, strong books. Sir.
What would you say to these people that are trying to justify the way they vote? By saying, there's a certain separation between church and state. What you believe in religiously should not affect how you vote.
I would say, Mom. No. No, that's not my. My mom's not really like that. I don't know what to say. I mean, I believe that the American experiment in what we call ordered liberty, it has been obviously, I mean, it just seems so obvious to me, the most successful form of government for a large society ever invented, that I don't know why you would want to give that up in any way. Well, what are the things that went into making it successful? Among the things are, one, it's written down in these magnificent documents that we have, okay, from the Mayflower Compact all the way up through the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States and the Bill of Rights. And all right, so it's pretty good, all the written stuff. But also, American culture contributed to that success. And that culture is a vibrantly religious culture, always has been. Please God, always will be. Why would you want to say, let's take one of the legs off of that stool, that'll improve it? You know, doesn't make any sense to me.
Earlier you talked about solidarity as a preference for the poor and the
know there are a lot of Catholics that are motivated by that, but I notice also that those sort of economic issues aren't on the non-negotiableness, so I was just curious what was the standard level
I said it's not perfect. That's what I meant. Yeah, it does seem, I know what you mean, but there are ways in which economic issues can be non-negotiable. Part of the problem is, however, that when somebody says, okay, let's take a basic economic issue, welfare, okay? When somebody says we need to fund welfare more, okay, because of the inherent dignity in the human beings and people should not be forced to live at these subsistence poverty levels, okay? And then another person says, we should fund welfare less because it insults the dignity of the person, it keeps people from working, and work is a basic good, it excludes people from society by pushing them off into one area and not encouraging them to become more educated. Neither of these sides has violated a non-negotiable. You have to assume goodwill on both sides. There may not be, one might be really mean and the other might be really, you know, like canny politically and just trying to, you know, manipulate people. I don't know. But if you assume goodwill on both sides, then you have to say nobody has violated a non-negotiable. This is a question of prudence. That's part of the problem of economics is economic theory is lousy. I mean, you can't hardly get two economists to agree on much, you know? I mean, there are economic laws, obviously. We're just not that good at knowing how to apply them. So it's very, very hard on economics to say that is clearly a Catholic position, that is clearly not a Catholic position. A position like a fascist position on economics, where the government controls corporations, and we could probably say that's not Catholic. A communist one, where there is no personal property, like Cuba, all right, where that's loosening up, I hear, but no, that's clearly beneath the dignity of the human being. But on the American scale of how much should we fund welfare, there's probably very few people anyways who are violating fundamental principles. What they're doing is negotiating over the fundamental principles. It's a tough one. That's a really tough one. Sir?
So you relate to the whole like non-negotiable thing you feel okay. So once you get down there, let's say you are able to get down to 4 or 5 now, right, then non-negotiables, where would you go from there? Now that you have, what would be the next step after eliminating non-negotiables?
Yo, that's a great question. That's a great question. And the idea is we're trying to, okay, we'll name a few things. Utopianism, idealism, realism, and nihilism. Let's just take those as four. Utopianism would say we could build a perfect world. Idealism would say we could build a heck of a lot better world. Realism would say, interesting world, all right? And then nihilism would say, who cares? All right, these would all be on the spectrum. Then as a Catholic, you can't be unrealistic in your politics. That is, respect for reality is a basic tenet of the Catholic faith. How do we respect reality? We respect reality both by embracing the faith that's been given to us and by embracing our basic ability to reason. So we can't be utopians. In many ways, we can't even really be idealists as Catholics. What we have to do is, in an intelligent and faithful way, try little by little to help society to do the things that are going to do good and avoid evil, as St. Paul says. Do good and avoid evil. And we have models. We have things that we know they didn't work. People tried them in good faith. They didn't work. All right? And we have other models that show promise. So this is the application of prudence in the political sphere. Once one has said, there are certain evil things I cannot participate in, okay, but those are limited. Now I've got candidates to choose from, and I've got parties to choose from, and I've got political positions to take, and I've got ballot initiatives to vote on. Well, then we have to make sure we're not being overly utopian, idealistic, or nihilistic, but that we're being realists who are also, a part of our realism is our faith, and that we're doing good and avoiding evil. Now, something on, say, your town wants to float a bond issue to, you know, to fix schools. Some people are going to look at that and go, No, because I don't trust them to float the bond issue, because the last time we did a bond issue, they did one of those Poway things, right? If you don't know what the Poway thing is, you should, or you know what it is, huh, Elizabeth? We borrow $100 million, but we pay back $1 billion. That's a good loan. Nice going, Poway. All right, I want to loan money to Poway. All right? So, maybe somebody could say, well, that's a good thing, but I don't trust these people because look at the stupid thing they did before. We got to pay $1 billion back now. So there's always going to be prudential reasons to consider, is this really a good idea, or is this something that's where we're not avoiding evil clearly enough? We're trying to do good, but we're not avoiding evil.
You're saying that, of course, you can't like kill other people with wheelchairs or whatever, but you didn't explicitly say you can't vote for this politician. I was wondering, I was trying to tie into something more recent about like denying communication about things.
Yeah.
People talking about that, would that fall into like more direct political activism that the church has in the sense of trying to shy away from? Or does, I can see that again, trying to make arguments saying politicians have a big public audience, they can influence people towards certain things. Is that grounds for excommunication? Is there?
Yeah. You know what really good canon lawyers argue about it? And I'm not a really good canon lawyer. And a lot of that has to do with the internal discipline of the church, not necessarily the choices that we're individually making as citizens. But there is such a thing as giving scandal, and it's a very serious sin. And giving scandal means, it doesn't mean like, oh, you know, I saw your underwear. It means like, presenting the Catholic faith as something that it is not, all right? So when you have a politician who says, you know, I'm Catholic, but, you know, the church, I'm more in touch with the future Catholic Church. That's what a lot of them are doing, you know? I know in the future the Catholic Church will be more pro-abortion. So I'm with that future church. Present church, not so much, okay? Well, that's just clearly wrong, and they're giving what's called counter-witness, and they're giving scandal. It's up to bishops to decide how to handle that. My own view is that bishops have been too mild. They should take their responsibility more seriously in some cases. But you have to remember, the bishops have a very deep responsibility for maintaining communion where they can maintain communion. And it's not a bishop's job to go throwing people out of the church. Hey, you're out. You know, that's not their job. Their job is just the opposite of that. If there is a way to maintain communion, they're supposed to try to find it. But not compromising their teaching. Role either. So my own view is that, yeah, a lot of bishops have been a little too easy, but a lot of you won't remember what the church was like in the 1970s. And I honestly believe in my heart of hearts, many bishops thought there was about to be true schism in the church. Schism, like that parish leaves the diocese and starts its own new diocese and 10 parishes go this way and 20 parishes go this way. I believe that the bishops truly were looking in the 1970s at a possibility that that would happen. And I do believe many of them moderated their harshness because they really did not want to have that happen again. It has happened to the church before, and it's horrible when it happens. So were they right or wrong to moderate themselves for those reasons? I could never stand in judgment. I mean, there's no way to stand in judgment on such a grave decision. But I will say, my strong sense is too many bishops were too mild. They should have said, no, you cannot hold that position and be a Catholic on some of these things, you know? And I'll get the prime example, of course, is Ted Kennedy, all right? And Ted Kennedy voting for partial birth abortion, at that point, no. You just have to, in my view, there's no way you can allow that to go on and in good conscience. But I don't know everything. I could be wrong about that. Their job is hard. A bishop's job is really hard. You may think it's easy, but it's a tough one. It's a tough one. Okay, what? Any more? Yes?
What would be the danger? Because there has to be a reason why you have mentioned before about why the bishops and the hierarchy of the church doesn't come out and endorse a certain thing. So what would be the danger in doing so?
Well, breaking communion. That is, the bishop the bishop's role is to be the in persona Christi, that is, to stand in the place of Christ for us in the local church. He's a vicar. In the same way that the Pope is the vicar of Christ on earth, the bishop is his vicar in this local place. And Jesus was kind of remarkably apolitical, you know? And so Jesus, like when the centurion comes to Jesus and says, you know, can you heal my servant? And there, you know, it was fancier talk in the Bible, but you know, the basic idea was, can you heal my servant? And then he said, remember the part where he says to Jesus, you know, I'm a centurion. I give an order, or a legionnaire or whatever he was. I think centurion. I give an order, they follow my orders. I know if you give an order, that order will be followed. And Jesus was like, wow, I'd never seen somebody with such deep faith. He never said to the guy, yeah, but I'm not helping you. You're part of the corrupt Roman system, you know, of fight the power, man. He didn't do all that. He healed the servant. So I do think bishops have to be cognizant of that's their role. They are there to draw everyone to Christ. Even people, look, you could be the stupidest person in the world when it comes to politics. You could get every vote of your life wrong. You could be completely on the wrong side of every political issue that ever comes up and be a saint. I know, because some of the saints were, and I'll name them if you want. No, I won't. I won't name them. But politics is something that we're supposed to have the heart to do it the way Jesus would want us to do it, but that doesn't mean we're going to get it right. And getting it wrong does not disqualify you from being a member of the faith community, okay? Willfully getting it wrong after your bishop has told you, you must stop that, and you're publicly taking these positions, not a private thing of the heart, but publicly take, then we have a problem because you're hurting other faithful. But if just me, little old me, I screw everything up politically, all my votes go the wrong way, you know, that has no relationship to my relationship to Christ, as long as it's not willful on my part. So bishops have to be cognizant about that. There's people who really truly can't see what you see, or don't have the moral clarity or education or whatever to be able to see it. They're still our brothers and sisters in Christ. That's why we should never be divided politically. I mean, we shouldn't be like, the Republican, that's the Republican side of the church, and that's the Democrat side of the church, and this is a conservative parish, you know. Sometimes when I go and talk to parishes and I do a parish talk, people will say that to me, like, well, this is a pretty conservative parish. Sometimes they're saying it as a description. That's fine, okay? That's just a description. That's a conservative. But sometimes it's like, why is your parish a political thing at all? Your parish is a place to receive Christ. It's not, and Christ is welcoming everybody, right? Even the, you know, even the people who disagree with you politically, not the people who disagree with me, but the people who disagree with you. Nah, even me. Sir.
If that's the case in the church, and you say Jesus didn't get involved in politics, is complete disengagement from politics an option?
Oh, that's a great one. And here's the deal. Say it again? Yeah. Well, it may have been a political act. It's not entirely clear. That does also seem to have been a prophetic act. That's right. That's a political statement, but it's like the most apolitical political statement you can make. Well, render unto Caesar what Caesar's. It's like, don't bother me about it. All right. But I mean, there's something about the image of Caesar on the coin. Of course, you all know that. When Jesus says render unto Caesar, whose image is on this coin is what he says. Well, what he means is whose image is on you. Okay. God's image is on you. That's the point of that, or that's at least part of the point of that whole story. But you're saying, can we just withdraw from politics? Some people can, because they are truly apolitical creatures. That is, they're, you know, it just, maybe they have a social phobia, or they have a, you know, there's something, or they just don't think in those terms, or they maybe can't think in those terms. But for most of us, no, we can't. And part of the reason that we can't is we live in a democracy. And please don't tell me, no, we don't, we live in a republic. Because we live in what's called a republican form of democracy, all right? So we do, in fact, live in a democracy, and that means you are carrying the obligation of a king. See, in the Middle Ages, The king had to make the decisions, or the duke, or whoever was the particular potentate locally. Now that's you. You're stuck with that. A king can't go, I'm kind of an apolitical king, all right? I'm really not into politics, so whatever. We could invade, we could not invade. You people decide, all right? That you can't do that. So the role of the king has accrued to you because of the modern revolutions, and you can't get out of it now. You are the ruler. You can't be a lazy ruler. You have an obligation to rule, and the Bible has all sorts of injunctions about how rulers are to rule. Every single one of those applies to you now. Okay, so you have to think, if I have this kingly responsibility or queenly responsibility, what's the dignity with which I should execute that role? All right, you can't get out of it unless you have a profound reason to get out of it, where maybe you have a disability that doesn't allow you to function in that way, or you have responsibilities to take care of somebody that doesn't allow you to be very politically. All those things could, but for most of us, we're healthy enough, we're with it enough, we have the kingly duty on us. It sits on us just like on King Solomon. Yes?
You talked about the schism of the church in the 70s and Roe versus Wade. It all seemed to be results of the sexual revolution.
Yeah.
Is there a political path forward in that, or is there something the church is doing besides, like what John Paul II's theology of the body?
Yeah, but the theology of the body has very strong political implications. You know, as lay people, that's an amazing teaching, the theology of the body, at least the way that I understand it. And I know there's a lot of arguing about who's really teaching the right theology of the body and who's not, and all that stuff's going on. But in general, if you take the general outline of the theology of the body, as a gift that can be given or withheld, and the self as a gift that can be given or withheld, and when the body is given sexually and the self is withheld, the body's lying, okay? That's, as I understand it, that's the basic crux of the theology of the body, is the sexual revolution is about lying to one another. We're committing acts with one another that speak a language that is a deceptive language, okay? So that certainly has political implications, yeah. And I mean, like for me, something that I think is so basic is, here in California, we have these 17 and 18-year-old girls or young women who come here, they want to be movie stars. So they go to LA. Many of them are very innocent of how they could be manipulated. They end up in porn movies, right? Which has become this plague on our whole culture. Well, why should we allow that? That should just be illegal. You'd say you can't be in porn movies till you're 25, at least. Grow up. Don't let them prey on these. A lot of these people are not exactly on the top of their game either. They need a few more years to get there because they've been abused or they've been, so yeah, that has political implications, that how we treat, whether we embrace the dignity of the person or not. I think it does have implications. The sexual revolution is part of a broader revolution, however. It's a revolution away from the idea of that God is moving in history. That is, we gave up on that idea. Many people after the First World War, some people sooner than that. Certainly Darwin had a say in that. There's all the revolutions, intellectual revolutions and political revolutions that followed, let's say, the storming of the Bastille to today, meant a lot of society has given up on the great project of the people of the medieval times, who, by the way, medieval times, did I just, okay, that's like a place you go, medieval times, but you know that the medieval period is denigrated all throughout the modern period. Even in your history classes, they will denigrate the medieval period. Why do they do that? In large part, that's a habit of the modern mind that wants to get away from what the medieval people have that we don't have. Things have not gotten better since the Middle Ages in every way. It hasn't all been progress. Think about that. In the Middle Ages, they weren't, there was no genocide. There was hardly even, what could be, this, we exaggerate the evils, in other words, of the Middle Ages. And we do that because we don't want to look at the evil that we've gotten ourselves wrapped up into. Sexual revolution is a big part of that. But it goes even earlier and it goes deeper. Yep. That's a really tough one. And I will say that there's some leeway there in the way that the church teaches. But in general, since the papacy of John Paul II, the thinking of the church has become concentrated around the idea, not that capital punishment is always wrong or has always been wrong, but that capital punishment is no longer morally justifiable because society now has the means to protect itself otherwise. Okay? So John Paul was very forceful in teaching that. There's no way for us to get around that, to weasel around that. So the idea is, maybe, like, to me, intellectually, I arrived at a pro-death penalty position. I thought the death penalty kind of makes sense morally and intellectually. I was there. I wasn't a big... But when John Paul started teaching like that, you have to ask about your own disposition. Are you willing to listen to what the church is saying in this great teacher, John Paul, or are you going to stick to the things that, you know, what makes you comfortable? And I'm not saying this to you. I'm talking about my own experience of this. And there's just no doubt that the church is currently teaching that the place for capital punishment in the modern world is virtually non-existent. We have to say virtually because we can't say absolutely, because the church has taught in the past that capital punishment is acceptable in some circumstances. So if the church has taught us through these two magnificent popes that capital punishment is virtually unacceptable in the modern context where society has other means that it can resort to, that's where we have to dig down and say, do I have the disposition to listen to this, or do I want to keep struggling against it? It's a non-negotiable because it's been taught so clearly. And it's not the teaching that I would have expected from these popes, but it is the teaching that they gave us. They are the vicar of Christ. I'm not. And so capital punishment is one of those things that, as a Catholic in good conscience, we have to be against in the modern context. We don't have to say that it was always wrong to execute people. As a matter of fact, we can't say that because the church never said that. But we do have to, in the modern context, be opposed to the death penalty. Go ahead.
How far should we go to be convinced? Like, here's, I mean, like, you get convinced by hearsay, by friends, by media, by, you know, this or that. You know, people say one thing and do another. Look, like, you know, the whole homework thing. Like, how far would you say we should all be doing that to be over, like, okay to be convinced? Because...
Yeah, okay, first of all, are you an obsessive person? Because some people are obsessive, and really, if you're an obsessive person, the church is never calling you to become obsessive, all right, to obsess over things. That's not what the church does. But you have there's a very high standard for the formation of conscience, which means you got to do your homework. You got to find out, what does the church say about this? What do the scholars say about this on a moral issue? So to just go, you know, there's different people saying different things about abortion. I don't know. I'm just throwing my hands up. That's not adequate formation of the conscience, okay? What's the traditional teaching of the church? Well, first of all, what does the Bible say? What do the fathers of the church say? What's the tradition that we can recognize? And how is that tradition expressed today in the present teaching? There's no question about it, all right? So you do have a serious moral obligation to form your conscience. That means choosing. I choose to want to do exactly what the church is teaching. Okay, once you've choose to want to do that, once you've made that choice, then you just have, then look, you might get it wrong, but you got to do your best under those circumstances to know what is the church really teaching. And always remembering, you don't have the obligation to be scrupulous about it. You don't have the church never asks you to be a perfectionist in the obsessive sense, only a perfectionist in the sense of trying to perfect love in your life, the love of the truth, the love of your brothers and sisters, all that. Okay? Yep.
Give us some other resources you would
Yeah, like, say you wanted to know, what is the church teaching on torture? Or what is the church teaching on pornography? Or what's the church teaching on the death penalty? That's what you mean? Like when these things come up? Catechism of the Catholic Church, man, that thing rocks. That thing is so good, and it really is good. It's one of the great achievements of the church post-Vatican II. So you can just look it up, and they got St. Charles Borromeo Church in Florida has, or now the Vatican has a, you can just search it. You put in the word, like, torture, and it'll come up and tell you why torture's wrong. Not all of them are fully fleshed out. Like, actually, in that sense, I chose torture. I've always thought that what the Catechism has to say on torture needs to be developed more in light of the way history is moving. But there is a good basic teaching there, and then it always has footnotes that'll refer you to other things. Sir? Well, what's a more important issue to us Catholics now, the fight for life or the fight against secularism? Not all secularism is bad. I mean, you got to start right there. There's a kind of secularism that's bad, but certain things should be secular, like government should be secular. That's a basic, I think we've learned that lesson. We've had thousands of years to think about it. Secular government works better. So not all secularism is bad. But we're getting into a very sick kind of secularism, which is relativist, atheistic secularism that's just crazy. It's just losing its mind, and it's very disturbing. And I don't know, if you don't fight that, how can you fight for life? Because when you have people like Peter Singer at Princeton University, is that where he is? Princeton, yeah, Princeton University, one of the world's most renowned ethicists, saying really, truly, parents should be able to kill their children anytime before the child can talk. That's what he's saying. This is what a major university philosopher of ethics is saying, that why should parents, I mean, you get a kid, it doesn't work out, all right? That you should, it's okay, to, as long as the kid can't talk yet, the kid doesn't know, you should be, you think I'm kidding, you think I'm making that up. That's what's going on among the secularists who are of this mad secularist bent. It's very unhealthy. Look him up, Peter Singer, you can Wikipedia him. Some of you could Wikipedia, what's that? Were they? That's not good, we're not for that either. Peter lost his way, man. He should see that. But it's craziness. But there's a lot of people who are taking these views that, why shouldn't we, for example, why shouldn't we invent new kinds of human beings? We can manipulate the genome. Why not invent new kinds? Wouldn't it be great if we could breathe underwater? There's one guy at Harvard, now I'm going to forget his name. If you can think of it, you can help me. But I wrote about him once. He wants to put a human brain in a monkey. Okay? Do you know what that is? You know what that is? That's insane. Okay? That's you've gone beyond just morally wrong. Now you've gone to mad scientist. That's like literally, you're in mad scientist territory. That's what happens when secularism becomes unhinged. Okay, so here's what I would like you to discuss at your tables right now. Well, first of all, nobody asked me who I was supporting for President of the United States. And I want to make a statement right now and be as clear as I can be. I am supporting the candidate who will pick a Catholic vice president. I am. I'm serious. What? Romney has already done that. There we go. Wait a minute, so has Obama. Okay. No, I don't mind talking about who I'm voting for because I don't want to bother you with that. Here's what I would like you to ask at your table. What are the things we can do not to be good citizens, but to dispose ourselves to be good citizens? How can we, in other words, make sure that our hearts are truly seeking the good and not just seeking to justify what we already believe? All right? How can we allow ourselves to become people who are truly seeking the good and not just people who are seeking justifications for what we already basically believe? Ready? Go.